The Guardian. Music Weekly on guardian.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to Music Weekly. This week, a protest music special.
Wait until the war is over. And we're both a little older. The unknown soldier. Preface where the news is read. Television, children fed, unborn living, living dead. Bullet strikes a helmet's head. It's all over for the unknown soldier. It's all over for the unknown soldier.
Hannah Peel there, covering The Doors' Unknown Soldier. Welcome to the programme. I'm Alexis Petridis, and this is a special Music Weekly on the subject of protest music. We've come to this topic because a book on the subject, 33 Revolutions Per Minute, is about to be released by a friend of the podcast, Dorian Linsky. Hello, Dorian.
Hello, Alexis.
We're also joined by the editor of Film and Music, Michael Hann.
Hello, Alexis. Hello. Hello, Dorian.
We'll each be picking a standout protest song to pick apart at the moment. But before we do, Dorian, let's talk a little bit about the book. What prompted you to write it? Why did you start writing it?
I suppose it was something that I'd been interested in all the time, you know, since I was a teenager, and that two of my main interests are music and politics. They're kind of like my hobbies. And it just seemed like it was too big a topic to write a book about. But then I got this concept of the 33 chapters, 33 songs. And then by the time I realised that it actually was too big, I was too late and I'd written it. So, you know, it just felt like it was something I was very passionate about. And I also felt that many people were very cynical about. That not only was it a slightly waning, well, very much waning art form, I think, but many people criticize it for being preachy, for not working, for being contradictory. And I kind of wanted to defend it and say, actually, this is brilliant pop music a lot of the time. It does the things that great pop music does.
I see. You started writing it quite a long time ago, didn't you? It's like 3 years?
Yeah.
3 years. Which is sort of intriguing, because obviously it's taken an enormous amount of research to do. It is a weighty term. How many pages is it?
It's about 650 of text, and then you get source notes and index and
it's
stuff.
It's a big, big old book. But weirdly, I guess, you've ended up publishing it at a time when protest music is theoretically on the rise.
Well, protest is on the rise, and you can't really have protest music without the street protests. Now, you know, you turn on the news, and there's always signs of, you know, of street protests.
Sure, sure.
Even, you know, I noticed that there was one in Greece the other day, and it was almost forgotten. Because there was so much other stuff going on.
Do you think the instant nature of news these days, the fact that everyone knows everything as soon as it happened, kind of rather prohibits protest music in a sense that, because a lot of those songs were communiques, weren't they? They were sending this information out to people. People don't need information in that form anymore because they have it all the time anyway.
Well, the really old protest songs, the sort of broadsides, you know, go back to the 17th century, were news bulletins, really. But, you know, when you move into the TV era, you know, people knew about the Kent State shootings. It didn't mean that Ohio couldn't bring that emotional resonance to it. And I think sometimes it's not the information in the song. In fact, sort of infamously, a lot of Dylan's protest songs were sort of factually inaccurate or extremely jaundiced.
The times they weren't changing, I believe.
No.
The answer wasn't blowing in the wind.
It wasn't even windy that day. It was all lies. It was quite a soft rain was a falling.
A gentle drizzle. A gentle drizzle.
But, you know, it was kind of the emotion that mattered. And you know, I spoke to the BBC's Arabic correspondent the other day, and he said that when he was in Tahrir Square in Cairo, there were people writing protest songs all over the place. And there were literally an 80-year-old guy who had been singing protest songs since the 1940s teaming up with some rapper.
Wow.
And it was kind of this completely sort of the sort of thing that you think doesn't happen anymore, which is the communal writing of songs at a moment in history.
It's a very old school kind of approach to protest songwriting.
Sorry. I was actually going to ask you about the 80-year-old Egyptian guy, because he seemed to be a glaring omission from your book.
There are many glaring omissions. They glare like the sun.
Has there been, I mean, it's interesting mentioning the protest in the Middle East, because there's obviously the big kind of you know, revolutionary movement at the moment. Often you get kind of revolutionary movements on this scale. Has it sort of filtered down into pop music there? I mean, obviously you've got your 80-year-old guy in the square writing stuff on the spot. Has it influenced, to your knowledge, popular culture in places like Egypt?
Well, interestingly, the sort of old arguments are being had there, according to this guy who had been in the square, and he said that a lot of young Egyptians felt that the only valid protest songs were the ones written by people who were in the square.
Right, right, right.
And that a couple of weeks later, you know, a week, 2 weeks later, you ended up having mainstream Egyptian musicians coming along and doing their tribute to the events there.
Right.
And they were seen as kind of bandwagon jumpers, fakes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, which is interesting because
it's like one big comment is free blog over there, isn't it?
You can't have a protest song without a row about it.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I found interesting, is that every protest song annoys somebody, you know, and sometimes somebody you would think would be behind that song disagrees because of it's the timing or the phrasing or whatever. So it's interesting that so much of the stuff that I was writing about, I can actually sort of observe happening out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in this completely unexpected uprising.
Yeah, because there's a discourse going on there that simply wasn't going on 6 years ago. You know what I mean? There wasn't really any protest music to discuss 6 years ago, was there?
Not in this concentrated form. There was scattered protests. But I think it's become almost sort of a bit of a dominant narrative of the times. So obviously, we're looking forward to, you know, a year of cuts and protests against this government now, you know, and that all that kind of, there's a Tory in number 10 and suddenly all that kind of rage comes out. What's happening in Wisconsin with the unions, you know, Tom Morello is out there playing old union songs. And it just seems like when these protests happen, they reach for songs. And I'm just reminded that actually possibly the last chapter of my book is, I would revise a little more optimistically now because I suppose I didn't see this coming when, you know, last autumn.
We'll talk about this a bit later as well, because we've got an interview with The Agitator, who is a sort of self-proclaimed protest singer who performed some of the student occupations and things like that. So sort of interesting, you know, to talk about those kind of areas. And you say people reaching for music and what music they reach for. We'll talk about that later. What we're going to now is a sort of version of Singles Club, but a protest song-based version of Singles Club. The three of us have all brought in a protest song of our choosing for various reasons, I'd imagine, maybe, you know, musical, maybe message, whatever. But let's have a listen to them. The first one is Michael's choice.
Pick up the pieces.
That's Bonsai Goes to Bitburg by the Ramones, Michael Hann. You brought that in. Tell us why. Why did you choose? It's an interesting choice. Ramones, not a band known for the political content of their music.
I think the single time I think the Ramones ever tried to deal on anything to do with politics, and frankly, if you read the lyrics, they don't make an awful lot of sense. This single came out in summer 1985. It was a kind of rushed release thing by the Ramones, the first time they ever did anything like that. It was a response to President Ronald Reagan's visit to the Bitburg Cemetery in Germany, where there were SS, previous SS members, buried. Joey Ramone, a Jewish man, took great exception to this and churned this song out very, very quickly. I think it's the last great Ramones song. I mean, that's the real reason it's precious to me. But the kind of inchoate anger of it seemed wholly appropriate. It wasn't some well thought out protest with you know, logical thought behind it. It was a kind of howl of melodic rage. But again, slightly divorced from what you might have thought they would have done, given that the Ramones at that point were hugely influencing the American hardcore punk scene, where there's a lot of very explicitly political music. Mm. It wasn't like that. It still seemed like a pop-punk record. But of course, I think this song really highlights one of the oddities of protest music as well, which especially when you've got bands doing things, which is that people don't all think the same.
No.
Now, Joey Ramone's bandmate, Johnny Ramone, was a committed Republican, huge supporter of Ronald Reagan, and was furious about this song. And when it finally appeared on an album the following year, he'd insisted on it being retitled as My Brain Is Hanging Upside Down, which sounds like a far more Ramones song title. It sounds like somebody won their novelty ones about having to have a lobotomy when you're 12 or something. but it's there's two lines in it, I think, which where Joey Ramone's rage really comes out, which we didn't hear on that little clip, towards the end of the song, where he really snarls, "If there's one thing that makes me sick, it's when someone tries to hide behind politics." Now, again, for a protest song, you're not actually offering a lot there, but I think that's the real insight into Joey Ramone, a man who, you get the impression, didn't really give a lot of attention to what was happening on the news every day. But this single thing had energised him so much. This one thing in his life had energised him so much that he wanted to say something. And in a way, I think that it's as pure as a protest song can be for that reason.
It's one of the interesting things that comes up, I think, as a result of this song, is that you have, as you say, one member of the band who clearly didn't believe in the cause or whatever that the song is espousing. And, you know, famously, Johnny Ramone didn't agree with lots of Ramone's songs. You know, he wasn't very keen on the idea of "Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue." I presumably he wasn't particularly keen on "The KKK Took My Baby Away," which is about him. but there's that sense of somebody making protest music because it is commercially expedient, which we've talked about before on the podcast when we talked about the Motown, sort of the late 60s. Motown sort of wave of protest songs produced by Norman Whitfield, who by all accounts couldn't have given a monkey's either way about any of the issues he was talking about. Dorian, are you a fan of this? Is this
and I think what complicated it for me when I was doing research was that as far as I could tell, Joey Ramone had been a Reagan supporter. You know, it's often seen as like Johnny was the Republican, and it's not, well, the rest of them, you know, coming from that early sort of Legs McNeil vision of punk, which was, you know, pretty libertarian conservative. It was certainly not markedly left-wing. And so what you have here is not a kind of seasoned lefty finding a way to attack Reagan. It was actually someone who had voted for him. And in that moment of kind of rage and disappointment, and that's why the song does not sound, you know, dead. That's why it sounds so alive, because actually the way it fell in their career as well, that sudden jolt of emotion, of awareness, of political conscience as something very visceral and immediate, not as something dry, actually produces their last great song.
Yeah.
Actually inspires the creativity. And I think the reason it sounds confused is because he was confused.
Yeah.
Because he was not the guy out of the Minutemen.
Yeah. Right.
Or he wasn't Jello Biafra. He was not trying to constantly bash Reagan. This was this one thing where he was just suddenly almost taken aback by his own outrage, I think.
I should just correct myself a little bit. I mean, I said the Ramones didn't do protest songs. Actually, on the previous album, Too Tough to Die, from the year before, there had been a couple of songs that were, you know, political with air quotes around them, written by Dee Dee Ramone. But, you know, they were so wretched because I think Dee Dee Ramone was actually trying to be serious and thinking things out on them. There was a song called Planet Earth 1988, which one of the worst political couplets in the history of the world. "The solution to peace isn't clear. The terrorist threat is a modern fear." Well, you know, you've nailed that one, Dee Dee, but really...
What, where is that inaccurate?
It sounded really so much like someone who wasn't bright enough trying to be bright. And then Bonzo Goes to Bitburg doesn't sound like that at all. It doesn't sound like a genius, but it doesn't sound like someone trying to do something that they're actually incapable of.
Well, it's that, you know, in some ways it reminds me of Neil Young's Ohio, because he did not write both. They were all really surprised, the others, because, like, Crosby wrote them, Stills had written one, Nash wrote them, and they were like, why is Neil writing one now? And it's that sort of, it's very simple, it's very pared down, it's just that gut reaction. He's not talking about Nixon's Cambodian policy. And sometimes that can be a real strength. Sometimes too much knowledge can kind of clot the lyric.
Yeah, I think that's really true. If you look at the point about Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, is that they were all always sort of writing protest songs of one form or another. But the other three, Crosby, Stills and Nash, tend to write in that terrible West Coast sort of didactic mode about everything. Teach your children, you do this, I know this, da-da-da-da. Neil Young songs aren't like that. Neil Young, whatever other things you want to make pin on Neil Young, his song's never didactic. It tends to be like, well, this happened. And it just leaves it open for interpretation. And I think that's one of the things that makes Ohio so strong, is that he's so pissed off that he actually does write this sort of, like, you know, finger-pointing, accusatory kind of song, which is that there isn't really anything else like it in his oeuvre.
Yeah, sometimes it's like this one. It's more powerful because of that. This is a very well-known Ramon song, I think, because it sticks out so much.
One of the things that's interesting is that you said about Joey Ramone being a Reagan supporter and then sort of this one thing flipping his wig. I wonder why, in the wake of Britpop's dalliance with Labour and the sort of disillusionment that subsequently happened with New Labour, you didn't get songs like that. The closest you get is something like You and Who's Army by Radiohead, where the general message of that song seems to be, you know what I mean? There's no sense of that kind of like, hey, I've been totally fucked over here. I've been used for political ends.
I think maybe events became too big. I mean, once you had the Iraq war, that kind of subsumed any of the we're unhappy about being duped about the small stuff, so to speak, beneath that. But again, it's not like the Iraq war spawned, you know...
You know, my theory on this is that people kind of... they talked themselves out of a direct angry protest song that sort of, as in so many ways, people are so much more self-aware. Everything is so much more meta now. And, of course, that makes a protest song very, very difficult. So what you have is songs like If You Tolerate This, Your Children Will Be Next, or You and Whose Army, which are sort of songs about defeat, yearning for action but not feeling quite capable of it, quite sort of elegiac. And the only, you know, Out of Time by Blur, very oblique protest song.
Yeah, God, yeah.
But again, kind of wistful and defeated. And I think Elbow's Leaders of the Free World is one of the only British records from that time, which totally just gets up there and gives it some welly. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's an interesting point, because this is something I talked about with the Agitator when he came in. This sense that in the modern day, protest songs are not a direct thing. You don't write in that kind of polemical way anymore, possibly for fear of alienating some of your audience. And, you know, if you look at probably the most successful protest record of recent years, Standing in the Way of Control by The Gossip, you would have no idea what that was about unless you'd been told it was protesting, you know, a ban on gay marriage. I mean, there's absolutely not a single line in that song that tells you anything whatsoever about it. And I had taken that kind of thing to be not an act of cowardice, but not wanting to alienate people in a time when you need to sell a lot of records. And
I don't think it's like that.
No, I think your point about everything being meta and people being a lot more self-conscious.
I think people are more scared of looking stupid, of looking daft, than they are of some kind of, you know, right-wing radio station boss pulling them. You know what I mean? I think the timidity is more cultural than actually fearing censorship or lost sales.
Yeah. I think that bleakness is really interesting, actually. I remember 5 years ago, we did a cover story in Film and Music about where were the protest songs for the war, pointing out a lot of the old stages, like Neil Young was touring across America, you know, saying what he thought, but where were the young bands? And apparently Emily Haynes from Metric cited this article on stage at some show and said, well, this is ridiculous. What about this song? And she went into God, I can't, Monster Hospital, was that, which was their single at the time, which she said was about the Iraq War, which was actually my favourite single that summer. Yeah, and I had no idea that was about the Iraq War. None at all.
You begin to sort of wonder, in that case, what the point is. Yeah. If you've got to read around it so much to get the inference. And it's different from You and Whose Army, or If You Tolerate This, Your Children Will Be Next. I mean, I have to say, I didn't realise that Out of Time by Blur was a protest song. That's the first I've heard about it. I mean, I know there's a video of a guy going off to war.
I only know it because of the video and because of an interview Damon Albarn did.
Yeah.
That is the problem. It's like people can tell you it's a protest song, but it's easily missed, which is why people go, there aren't any anymore. There are loads, but they don't. Unless it's something like Green Day's American Idiot, which you would have to be an idiot not to get. It's easy to miss them.
Let's move on. The next choice of track is mine. That's my choice. That's There But For the Grace of God Go I. That's a 1979 single by Machine. I brought it in for a number of reasons. One, because it's a totally fierce bit of disco. It's produced by August Darnell and co-written by August Darnell, better known in Britain at least as Kid Creole of the Coconuts fame. And that's another reason why I like this record, is that the guy behind it is seen as a bit of a joke figure in Britain for fairly obvious reasons, but he's actually... in his day, was a really intriguing and quite subversive writer and producer in lots of ways. He worked on a lot of kind of weird off-kilter disco stuff. The third reason I brought it in is because it is a disco protest song. Other things, it is a protest song about racism within the sort of middle-class Hispanic community of New York, which is not a subject that's addressed that often in pop music. It's expressed in pretty fierce and direct terms. Disco doesn't really do protest, which is a very strange thing when you consider that disco is, to a degree, born out of the Stonewall riots, its catchment, initially at least, before it explodes, you know, and becomes a global phenomenon, is... you know, downtrodden sections of society. It's gays, blacks, you know, Puerto Ricans, this kind of thing. And yet, it usually takes the form of being a very escapist music, understandably so. And this is a rare example, I think, of disco really addressing something. And that's why I brought it in. Doran, you mention it in passing in your book.
Because the way that, you know, when disco came along, I think you'd had a long time. There would be many years of political soul records, and they were beginning to sound pretty knackered. If you listen to stuff that OJ's Curtis Mayfield were doing by 75, 76, it was like, you really have run out of steam here. So you could understand that sort of escapist urge. And, you know, Nile Rodgers, who always had a very political reading of disco, he would claim that, you know, a lot of Chic songs had these, again, super buried meanings. Like, At Last I'm Free, he said, was inspired by when he was on a Black Panther demo and he got tear gassed. And he stumbled to the edge of Central Park. And it was like, At Last I'm Free, I can hardly see in front of me.
Wow.
And then Bernard Edwards, rewrote the song as a love song. And now, of course, nobody knows it's
political. Yeah.
But what the Machine one does was completely, specifically rooted in New York society at that time. There was a huge issue with ghettoization and middle class families moving out, and it's just an incredibly, it's an unusual thing. It's not saying, oh, life is hard in the ghetto.
No,
it's actually, it's like a morality play. It's going, if you let prejudice and fear dictate what you do with your family and you try and escape, sometimes you'll realize that, you know, you can't escape human nature.
Yeah. The closing line of the song is "Too Much Love is Worse Than None at All," which is a really interesting, because it's not pointing its finger on one level, at the sort of protagonists of the song. It's sort of saying, I understand your reasons for doing this. They're going to try and protect their daughter from what they see as undesirable influences or whatever. It's kind of a quite an emotionally complex song.
Yeah, and it's very specific. It names the parents. Mm. It's got this, you know, specific thing. And then it's got that line that... just, you know, no blacks, no Jews and no gays.
Which stands out. I posted this on Twitter yesterday, and that was the thing that people immediately leapt on. I went, have you heard that lyric? And it's like, yeah, you need to listen to the rest of the song. You know, I haven't sort of posted the world's first example of unbelievably racist and homophobic disco, you know. Michael, this, I presume, is not a song you're familiar with.
Well, no. But what you say about disco not being political, I've always assumed there was, I mean, even leaving aside the association with gay rights, a kind of implicit protest agenda to disco. Mm. By the nature of its very demand for escapism, you know.
Yeah.
Because you only want to escape something if life is wretched.
Yeah.
And that whole concentration on hedonism and on finding a new world in many ways seemed to me, you know, a fairly political statement in and of itself.
Mm.
Even before you get to the fact that, you know, they would take the disco took anthems about sexual expression, the expression of sexuality, you know, to the top of the charts around the world, which is kind of a song like "I Will Survive." So,
but that's not a song that, I mean, this is another point that comes up in Dorian's book, is that most of the disco songs that people think of as these sort of anthems of whatever weren't actually intended in that way at all. They had it laid onto them later.
Ain't no stopping us now. We're family.
No, I agree. But they became that. And even as they became those anthems, it was evident. The meaning was evident to anyone but 8-year-olds, which I was at the time, or half-wits, which I may also have been at the time. You know, I mean, "I Will Survive" was a gay anthem. You know, whether or not Gloria Gaynor sang it with that intent, and it became that very early on in its life. And that's a hugely political statement, even if it wasn't intended. I mean, again, that's a fascinating thing about disco, the unintended consequences of its success.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's... Yeah, Dorian, you're
gonna... Well, you know, it was a very democratic form, you know. It's sort of born on the dance floor. So, in fact, with these songs, it was less about the songwriter's intent than it might be in other kinds of music. It was like, if the people on the dance floor want "I Will Survive" or "Ain't No Stopping Us Now" to be about race or sexuality, then it is. And we should probably mention, actually, Carl Bean's "I Was Born This Way," because that was the first explicit gay disco song.
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, gay pop song in America. And inspired the current Lady Gaga single.
Mm.
And it wasn't a hit, but it was a major, major attempt. But actually, that and "There But for the Grace of God" are pretty much the only two balls out.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. There's actually, I thought it's a glaring omission in your book, but there was a label, super obscure, called P&P, which came out of Harlem, which put very kind of beloved of Larry Levan, put down very sort of low down, low production values, kind of dirty, fucked up music, just sort of on the cusp of kind of soul and disco. There's a couple of tracks on there. There's an album called Disco Juice. The best known track is the one that. The Mighty Dubcat sample, and it's just another groove. It's a track called Disco Juice. But there's a track they put out called Out of Work, which is a sort of fairly unflinching, you know what I mean? There's no money in the ghetto kind of song.
The thing is, a lot of people, you know, you had to tread carefully, because I don't know if you've heard the Philadelphia All-Stars, Let's Clean Up the Ghetto. Which the tune is quite good, but it's got all the stars of, you know, Gamble and Huffslay, you've got Teddy Pendergrass, and everybody's sort of stepping up there to sing about, you know, why the alleyways stink of piss and stuff. And it was a flop. And it was like disco people wanted their politics to be coded and almost, like Michael was saying, almost utopian.
Mm.
Before then, a lot of political soul was dystopian. It was
absolutely,
like, everything is so dreadful. And disco was like, what if we imagine ourselves a better world, a liberating world?
If we take enough drugs, we can be...
enough people, it will happen.
Yeah, you have a sort of sexual saturnalia, drug and sexual...
But you know, equally, I mean, I think looking at disco's history enables us to put politics on it. Mm. I mean, if you go back to, you know, the DJ who burnt the disco records at the baseball stadium, at the time that looked like a stupid stunt, probably. Mm. In retrospect, it looks like the forces of conservatism against the forces of progression.
Definitely,
at a musical level, but, you know, you extend from that easily.
It's definitely white middle class America
middle America, really, against, you know, the coasts, fundamentally. I mean, that it's all politics, isn't it?
moving on from the politics or otherwise of disco, Our final choice is Dorian's.
Picket lines, school boycotts, they try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people and me. Yes, you lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie.
Man, she's righteously pissed off. That's Nina Simone with Mississippi Goddam, which is from 1964?
Four, yeah.
Dorian, tell us why you brought this in.
I just find it the most extraordinary recording because she wrote the song within hours of hearing about the bombing of a church in Birmingham, Alabama, which killed four girls. And this song just came out. And you can imagine her just sort of going, you know, banging away on the piano like that, actually sort of furious and in tears. And this is a few months later. There wasn't a studio version, so it's, you only can hear live versions. And this, I think, was Carnegie Hall. And the audience pretty well healed.
There's a lot of nervous
white
laughter, isn't there?
Yeah, and what's brilliant, I mean, the bit that we've just played is when she's really built up the rage. But the amazing sort of bit of the record really is at the beginning, you hear her kind of making what seems like a joke, and the audience are going, oh,
yeah.
Oh. And then the next time she says something, they're like, like a little uncertain. And then she gets angrier and angrier, and suddenly they're like, oh, it's like an ambush. Mm. Like, oh my God, I didn't expect that. And then midway through, she goes, I bet you thought I was kidding, didn't you? And there is no laughter.
Wow.
At all. Everyone's like, just, you know, and then it gets to this bit, and the way she goes, Sister Sadie, there's a bit where she goes, this whole country is full of lies, you're all going to die and die like flies. And there would be nothing like that. You compare that to People Get Ready, Change is going to come, you know, any freedom song. You know, in folk, you could say Masters of War by Dylan.
Yeah.
Approach that kind of anger. But I think what was surprising here is that people did not expect it from her. This was Nina Simone. She hadn't written a protest song before. Mm. And it sort of creates this sort of, it's just this sort of split. It's like there's before, it's one of those before and after records. And it actually structurally, I realised that it reminds me of what I love so much about Pulp's Common People. Again, it starts off and it's just like, oh, it's pretty funny. This guy is like making a wry aside. And then it builds and builds and builds and never stops building. And he gets angrier and angrier. And by the end, you're like, this isn't funny at all. Mm. And I just think that's an incredibly clever way of reeling the audience in and sort of smacking them around the head.
Do you think it had an impact on rock music? Did the existence of a song like this make rock music angrier? Because you're absolutely right. The initial burst of soul songs about civil rights are very much in that kind of Curtis Mayfield vein where he's always in his songs the voice of reason. You know what I mean? Curtis Mayfield, I'm sure you'll give consideration, we can perish unjust to live together as a nation, this is my country too. You know what I mean? It's like, let's just all try and get along and people, you know. Do you think it sort of sparked angrier sentiments within the
band? I'm not sure. I think it almost sort of stands alone. You know, when I see its influence, what it reminds me of, it reminds me of things that were happening in the movement, you know, with you know, Malcolm X as opposed to Martin Luther King, with the Watts riots the next year, with Stokely Carmichael, Black Power, Black Panthers. You know, that seems to be almost the legacy of what is being expressed here. Mm-hmm. Whereas Soul, there was. I mean, this isn't a Soul record, but there was not another African-American record this angry for a long time afterwards. I struggle to think of a rock record that was that angry.
I mean, that's the incredible thing, is when you think about the incredible creativity of black music, I mean, from the 20s and 30s onwards, right through to the 60s and 70s, given the indignities and worse that were being committed against them, this combination of the incredible music and the suffering that was endured, the fact that so much of the protest music that came out was beautiful and positive, and it was about yearning for change rather than expressing the incredible anger that surely everyone must have felt, and so few records.
But maybe music generally just doesn't express that, because as Dorian said, it's not like until you get to things like, I guess, the MC5 or, you know, Volunteers by Jefferson Airplane, that you're getting really, really angry rock records. I mean,
they don't sound angry in the same way as the Nina Simone record.
Well, maybe Nina Simone's got a bit more to be angry about.
Yeah, that's true. And also, I mean, when we talk about angry rock, half the time, you think, well, what are these kids being angry about? Yeah, being angry about not being able to get out in their car after 10 o'clock. And it just sounds slightly pathetic.
It's also her personality, like that. That she was so formidable. Mm. And it was that intersection of the personality, that moment in history, where, you know, when she sounds angry, there is an absolute kind of regal, magnificent quality. Mm. You know, she doesn't get that slightly sort of screechy, yappy thing you have sometimes, like when it, you know, when punk singers get really angry. You know, it just sort of rises up, like she's sort of rising above the venue and this sort of, you know, with her terrible wrath kind of thing.
But an interesting thing, listening to that record, the thing that it occurred to me as a relevant comparison, rather than a piece of music, would actually be Woody Allen's Moose Joke from, you know, roughly the same time, being performed to roughly the same audience. It's also fundamentally, it's a piece about racism. It's the joke that ends with the Jewish couple in a moose suit being shot and mounted in the New York Athletics Club. And the joke is on the New York Athletic Club because it's segregated. Mm. You know, but that joke does what the audience at this Nina Simone show would have been expecting. It's saying, hey, but you know, it's all right. We know it's wrong, but it is a joke too, where she's not giving them that safety net.
Well, she does say at the beginning, she said, this is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. And she did have a lot of experience performing songs from Broadway shows. You know, I Love You, Porgy was one of her big hits. So the storytelling here, and the, you know, the sound of it, is actually moving outside. It's not from a soul tradition. It's not from a folk tradition. It's like a Broadway song, you know, that kind of narrative cleverness. And you think maybe that's what sets it apart. That's why nobody else could really follow her, you know, in that direction, because she was a black artist in 1964, but she was not a soul singer, you know. She was in her own little zone.
So we've talked a lot about protest music from the past, but what about the present? I spoke to Derek from The Agitator about playing student occupations and what it is to be a protest singer in 2011. Say no! Prior to this, you were in Eastern Lane.
That's right, yeah. Right.
It's a pretty radical change in direction. What prompted that?
It was a big thing to do with just kind of being annoyed with the music that was around, really, and not seeing anybody addressing all of the points that seemed to become more and more apparent amongst, especially the youth in the country, kind of demonstrating more and protesting more, really. And as far as I could see, there was no music that was kind of relevant to those people.
Why do you think there isn't?
Up until maybe a year ago, I think a lot of people who are kind of my age didn't really take that much of an interest in politics as much as they are now. Mm-hmm. And I also think for a long time it's been considered very uncool to make music that has any kind of social or political point behind it.
Your sound is very stripped down. Why did you opt for that?
I wrote the songs with Rob, who used to be in the band The Maccabees, and so we both came from very kind of white boy indie school of music, and we both wanted to do something that was completely different from that. We thought that the music should be completely different to the music that we'd been around before that wasn't addressing these points. And we got a lot of inspiration from early hip-hop music, which is just beats and someone testifying over the top of it, really. Mm. So we wanted to have it stripped down, simple, and also not to take the point away from the message, really. I think if you try and hide it behind loads of guitars or keyboards or bass lines, then often that's what people focus on rather than what you're trying to say with the music.
You played at some of the student occupations, didn't you?
Yeah.
At the end of last year. What was that like?
It was pretty incredible. Especially the biggest one we did was the UCL one. To go in and play to a room full of people who had been there they'd all been living there for about a week by the time we went in there. So they were very receptive and appreciative that somebody had gone in to do that. You got to learn to say no.
No. What's more important to you, selling records or people taking on the causes that you're talking about?
People taking on the causes that we're talking about. I don't imagine that we make the kind of records that are ever going to sell millions and get on. I think the nature of our songs probably stops them being in the mainstream enough to sell millions of records. So I think it's more important that we play in front of people and get people to listen to our records and keep spreading that message, and then they go on to do that. Well, I don't care
about the manifestos. Some bunch of boozers up there on the high horse. We really don't suffer from a lack of interest.
There's two sort of routes protest music can take, protest rock music can take. And one is something like Crass, where it exists completely outside of the mainstream and doesn't get any radio play and exists entirely on its own terms. Yeah. The other is something like The Specials, Ghost Town, where it's not even subversive that it's in the mainstream, it just happened to get into the mainstream and get into the charts. Which of those approaches do you think is better? Or do you think that latter approach of getting it into the charts now is just basically an impossibility?
I'm not sure if it's an impossibility, but I think that it's definitely a lot harder than it would have been at that time. Now everything in the charts is just so like washed out and watered down and dumbed down and just made purely for commercial reasons, that anything that isn't like that, I think will struggle to ever get into that world. But I do think that if you can merge the two together somehow, that's what we're trying to do. I don't want to make our music purely as this kind of elitist thing that never gets out of its own little world. I think it's silly to do that because you're kind of cutting yourself off from letting a lot of people hear your music if you do that.
I can remember in the early 80s, you'd read Smash Hits and you'd have like the Redskins in Smash Hits and they'd be saying things like, I remember what's been your big event of 1984? And this is, I'm like a 14-year-old reading Smash Hits, and the guy at the Redskins went, the miners' strike. The miners' strike will affect every single person reading this, blah, blah. And it was like, wow, this is an incredible thing, you know, if you think about that in that context.
Yeah.
And I wonder what's stopping, you know, in inverted commas, mainstream bands, already successful bands, from having some kind of message in their music. Because if you were like Coldplay and you wanted to do a song going, you know, whatever, fuck the cuts, whatever, you could do that. I mean, no one's going to stop you. I guess what I'm saying is artists, once they reach a certain level of success, have quite a lot of power to basically do or say what they want. And I wonder what's stopping people.
Themselves, I would imagine. For as much as Chris Martin, to use Coldplay as the example, champions lots of causes and everything, the lyrics to his songs, they raise absolutely no issues about anything. And I think that would challenge, I think maybe, do you not think they would be a bit scared to challenge the people who buy their millions of records, everything they do?
Even if
it is people who would be directly affected by these spending cuts or something, if they were to all of a sudden come out with a song like that that wasn't such easy listening and was trying to raise some issue, I think they might be afraid that they would be alienating most of their audience if they were to do that.
I think it's really telling that if you get a band like Radiohead, who clearly are political and clearly have a political outlook, the lyrics are, for the most part, so oblique that you can take it or leave it, message-wise. Yeah. I mean, there's a song on the new album that could be about the banking crisis, if you read it one way, or it might be about something, like, you know what I mean? It could be about anything. And I think it's really intriguing that even a band like that, who are in a position of immense power, clearly don't want to put anything too direct in their music. You know, they keep their activism as a separate thing.
Yeah.
And that's how I guess you're probably right. You know, people are scared of... It's tough times. People are scared of alienating potential listeners.
Because of the state of the music industry as well, I would imagine people... Because they would be scared if they did make a record like that and it was to be kind of cut off the main part of their audience, they could quite easily shoot themselves in the foot, I suppose, as far as they're concerned. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're not willing to go out on a limb to do something like that.
I think also there's a fear of getting too directly involved in party politics.
Yeah.
A, because of Red Wedge in the 80s, where, you know, a lot of musicians banded together, try and get the Labour Party elected to no effect whatsoever.
Yeah.
And B, because of the whole Britpop thing where, you know, bands were co-opted, artists were co-opted by Labour and ended up kind of with egg on their faces in a way because they were seen to be supporting a government that turned out to do something very different to what people thought they were going to do, you know?
But then there's not necessarily any need to be associated with a particular political party if you want to follow in things like UK Uncut or the Coalition of Resistance or all of the student occupations. You can easily champion these things.
How difficult or otherwise is it to write activist songs, protest songs, because you always, you know, run the risk of being preachy, you always run the risk of being humorless, all these kind of things, which are an integral part, you know what I mean? Making music that people like is an integral part of doing what you do, you know what I mean? You end up in a situation like a band like Flux of Pink Indians, where they just made a horrendous noise because you were meant to pay attention to the lyrics and not the music, and that's a beautiful idea, but you wouldn't want to listen to
if you've got a message that you feel is strong enough, then I think if you're a good enough songwriter, you can make it into a song that's sellable to people or presentable to people anyway. I think it's just to do with how you go about putting it together, really. But like Public Enemy, I think they're always very much accessible songs to people, and there are strong points behind them, but they're also very kind of accessible 3-minute-long, 4-minute-long songs that people can dance to or listen to anywhere, pretty much. We can afford to hesitate. Now is the time to agitate. We can afford to hesitate. Now is the time to agitate. We can afford to hesitate. Now is the time to agitate. We can afford to hesitate. Now is the time. Come on, get ready.
Derek from The Agitator there. It's an interesting point that I think he raises about protest music in this era. He said that, you know, we're living in an era of protest and music will follow. What's happened thus far, I guess, is something not dissimilar to the disco situation that we were talking about before, where people have taken other and usually quite unrelated forms of music and claimed it as protest songs. Pow by Lethal Bizzle being the case in point, which was apparently the theme tune for at least a section
it's
of the
pretty
Steven
rum
Rhodes.
Lyric when you break it down.
Yeah, so mostly about guns.
Mostly about guns and gay people. It's quite an unpleasant song, but the one I really like is actually there's a dubstep song called "Where's My Money." It's got like one line in it. It's just some voice going, "Where's my money?" playing that outside Millbank, which I like.
Is there still a need for protest music if people can just take, you know, from a multiplicity of other forms of music and put messages onto them? Is it still needed? Is it still relevant, do you think?
I'd just be interested to see what happens next. I think that people do need something, and there is no reason why, you know, their soundtrack should have to be old songs or should have to be apolitical songs on which they put meaning. You know, if a song is good enough and powerful enough and strong enough, then I think there's totally a place for it. I think the problem is sometimes just a failure of nerve on the part of songwriters. And I'm hoping that what's happening now will give them that nerve to at least try it.
I think that's the interesting thing is, you know, you talk about people sort of laughing at people who write protest songs. And, you know, obviously there's that thing in the 80s where you get Red Wedge, which is this sort of enormous attempt at a party political movement that fails and sort of does become a subject of some derision. But if you do it well, I don't see anybody looking back and laughing at The Clash for their political convictions or The Special for their political convictions. I mean, I could see why people would find something like the Tom Robinson Band, which is incredibly earnest and sort of humourless and, you know, probably not that great musically, you know, sort of risible. But it's not like there's this grand tradition of protesting that everybody's going, yeah, he was stupid. Yeah, Bob Dylan, he was really stupid. I don't understand quite why they're so cowed.
No, I suppose what I wanted to do in the book was to remind people that a lot of the time it was just really good pop music, and that when you flick through it and you go, oh, actually, you know, The Clash, James Brown, Public Enemy, John Lennon, most reggae, you know, there's tons and tons and tons of really exciting political music, and the Straw Man protest song, which is incredibly, you know, worthy and a bit dim, is to me not really typical. I think there's plenty of stuff like, you can't really argue with, you know, Fight the Power or Ghost Town or Two Tribes or countless ones, you know what I mean?
Well, there you go. Positive thoughts for the future of protest music there, in whatever form, from Doreen Linsky. Thank you both very much for coming in. We'll be back next week. I'm Alexis Petridis. Thanks ever to my producer, Scott. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.